All right. There's handouts back there if you need one. We're going to look at a couple passages today. I'm going to draw a couple things again. All right, so kind of week in, week out, we've drawn this is the pasture where we play, okay? When we talk and we think about suffering, there's just things, convictions the Christian has that just kind of direct the way we talk, the way we think about the things that happen to us in our life, okay? So, right, the first one we started with was just from Genesis 3 through Revelation. We live in a storyline of what God is doing. If you don't like the term story, if you just want to call it God's plan of salvation, that's fine. If it makes it feel more real and less children's fiction-like to call it that, great. But it's what the Bible is, right? It's a story of God's dealings with us. So we plant ourselves in that story. When we look around, we actually talk about Genesis 3 and the fall that happened to Adam. And we get to Romans 5, and we get to a full adult man looking back at whatever story is revealed in Genesis 3. And he said, when I read Genesis 3, I see that all of humanity is dying because of Genesis 3. Everyone is born in Adam. They have a sin, a taint, a poison that comes with the day that they are created, the day they are born, and proceeds with them, and we can all see it grow up like a bad tree with bad fruit the whole time. That's what happens to each of us, but we're born with that poison in us. That's the story we're in, okay? And then, we moved on to different purposes that God has for suffering. So if practically in your life, if you don't actually believe that what happens to you, God is using for some purpose, you're going to have a hard time having faith that God's going to take care of things in the end. So me and the boys, we've been on for quite a while just reading the second part of Pilgrim's Progress. So in case you didn't know, there's a second part, which is incredible. You should read it if you haven't. And in the second part, there's this guy named Greatheart who is leading Christian's wife and sons through all of the same experiences that Christian had to go through. But he comes to blows with a giant, and he looks at the giant and he says, okay, you know, we're going to fight. The giant rushes at him. Okay, the giant strikes the first blow, knocks him down, but Greatheart ends up winning and slaying the giant so they can come out and go into Palace Beautiful. Well, afterwards, they're reviewing the whole story. Christiana is asking Greatheart questions like, what did you first think about when the giant rushed at you? Greatheart's first response out of his mouth is, I don't trust myself. I distrust myself, which automatically makes me think God is doing something else in this situation. Well, then Christiana follows up with, well, what did you think when he first knocked you to the ground with that first blow? And it's thought, Greatheart's immediate response is, my Savior was knocked with a serious blow right from the get-go, and yet he conquered to life. So in Greatheart's response, he with this fight with this giant, you see, he knows whatever is coming at him, he's interpreting in light of this. His picture is, of course I will conquer. This kind of spiritual allegory. So purposes that are there, right? And then, last week we talked about the end of suffering. So we did heaven and hell and just how the storyline finishes in a way that just clearly brings out exactly what God intends for all of this suffering, that it is finally dealt with. It is finally brought to its conclusion. All right, and now today, these don't necessarily fall in order, but today, we want to just focus on one of the incredible things about God's revelation is that in everything that comes with the stories of Jesus, the Gospels, the and then the interpretation that all of those apostles are working on, there is so much emphasis on the fact that God so understands suffering that his son actually embraces all that comes with that in order to secure our salvation. He doesn't stand aloof in any way. He actually comes and he embraces suffering so that we have a salvation. And so we just want to look at some of these passages that specifically talk about the cross and then try to unpack the cross with relation to our suffering. So you get these in place, and then whatever kind of suffering, it's just like whatever suffering has happened to you, you know the right questions to ask. Okay, what might God do this? What purposes might he be using for the trial that I'm going through? Okay, how has Christ condescended, seen, become a sufferer so he understands and then can bring a salvation that leads me to hope, right? Because the point of all, we're going to see in especially Hebrews, suffering, if it doesn't increase the heat of your faith, it's not doing its right purpose. All right, so that's kind of where we're going today. So three things. All right, for the cross, today we've got love and justice. Okay, and this is kind of the first point. So, does God suffer? And the answer is yes and no. All right. So when we did our class, the Doctrine of God class, a few weeks ago, we talked. I think this got mentioned specifically. We talked about a word called impassibility. Okay? So it's a heady term in some ways, but it just perfectly gets at something we've got to be holding in our minds, because if we don't have this, other things we think about God are just going to unravel as we start talking about what happened at the cross. So impassibility means that God does not have emotions in the way his creatures have emotions. So it's a negation, and then the Latin from passions as emotions, not just flaming like big anger only. So we talk about the effect of his emotions, and especially then also his non-suffering. Because what suffering then entails in who God is the ability to change. This is why it's an incredible thing. So I remember growing up and certainly hearing sermons that were so heavy on emphasizing that God so much cares about all of your suffering that he is always grieving in heaven. He is always affected by everything that's happening to you. He is doing all he can to try and relate to you. And then there's usually something kind of tacked on of, but don't worry, he'll take care of it in the end. But there's a sense in which none of what happens to creatures is affecting the very divinity of God. So we're holding this out and just making sure that we understand God in who he is, his being, is not just affected by what, I mean, is not affected in this way. That doesn't mean God's aloof or doesn't care about it. In fact, God is because he's the fullness of all of the attributes we talk about, his love, his justice, his perfection, all of those things he's the fullness of, that means he has full understanding of all of the suffering that's happening, and yet He's not changing like we do. Suffering implies we're less of something and we need restoration. We need something fixed. We need that, and that can't be true of God. Okay? So there's this line from a guy named Craig Carter. This is, what happens in the incarnation then? Because that's where the question happens. How do we start talking about Jesus? In the incarnation, it's for the purpose of redemptive suffering, because that's what happens. That's how God, in his plan, though he is impassible, he takes on human nature to himself so that he can suffer to save us. So when we think about God, when we think about God, and we're going to start talking about the cross, God, when he takes humanity to himself, Philippians 2, when he grabs humanity and he dons it on as his clothing in order to suffer and die, he is purposefully, the impassible God is taking to himself humanity for the purpose of our redemption. Yeah. In order for God to redeem us in the way that God had planned to, his plan was for him to take to himself a humanity that he could suffer in with us.
So that's the only way he could deal with
God. Right. Now, what we do want to say is that's the plan that he formed. That's the plan that he designed in order to deal with our suffering. If there was, we don't know the mind of God, but that was his plan that he has revealed to us. Yes. So what made that come up in your mind? What made, did he not complete it to Jesus? Yes. Okay. What, Deb? Oh, yeah. We were just discussing that in God's plan. This was God's revealed plan of how he would deal with human suffering, and it was the only plan that we have revealed to us. Is that the only way that this could happen was for God himself to don humanity, to take on humanity to himself, like we learn in Philippians 2, in order that he could suffer and accomplish what we're going to talk about he accomplished. So, all right? Yeah. Well, so in God's plan to save us, we don't know, as you're reading the Old Testament, you don't know how God is going to come to the rescue. What should we think? What does God think of our suffering? Well, we have different ways that God is described as caring for Israel and those kinds of things, but we finally know what God thinks of our suffering in what he reveals about Jesus. So what he feels about our suffering, we see in Jesus' compassion and willingness to complete the Father's plan and go to the cross. Well, specifically we know because of the Hebrews passage we'll get into. In Jesus, Well, so is your question, how then does God actually even feel the suffering at all?
Does Jesus take all the suffering?
Yes. Yes, so Jesus suffers in his humanity. Yes. Yep. Perfect. Thank you for being willing to stick with me until we got it clarified. So, all right. So all of that to say, now turn to Romans 3. All right, so suffering, if we're going to reflect on suffering, suffering should cause us to want a couple of different things. One, it should cause us to want an end to suffering, right? We should want it to be put away with. We should want to stop seeing people get sick, people die, people being hurt, oppression in all of its various forms and fashions. We should want an end to it. Okay? That's what the justice of God finally ends. Okay? But strangely enough, we don't want that in its complete form because it would put an end to us. Because we are participants in that. We have left as much stain as any other human people have in affecting and polluting God's world with our sin. Okay? So the question becomes, how can we actually believe that God's going to be just and finally finish suffering and can show us love and mercy because we're the ones who need it? Because if we want justice, and I can't stop for a second and realize I don't want justice on me, then we need a way to put these together. And Romans 3 is Paul's argument as to how that happens. So, verse 21, but now the righteousness of God has been manifested apart from the law, although the law and the prophets bear witness to it. Okay, so he's reminding there of everything else. The righteousness of God has said, if you can find yourself not to be a sinner, you'll never experience the justice of God. You'll never experience his wrath. You'll never experience being outside of him. If you can find yourself somehow outside of sin. Well, he just spent much of the last couple of chapters pointing out that you cannot find yourself outside of the category of being a sinner. So, verse 22, the righteousness of God through faith in Jesus Christ for all who believe. For there's no distinction, for all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. There's a summary of it. And are justified by his grace as a gift through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus. Okay, now here's the mechanics of it. Here's the mechanics of how he did this. Whom God put forward as a propitiation by his blood to be received by faith. Now, an explanation. This was to show God's righteousness because in his divine forbearance, he had passed over former sins. It was to show his righteousness at the present time so that he might be just and the justifier of the one who has faith in Jesus. Right? So when you hear justifier, you're seeing God's mercy, his love, being poured out on those who believe. Okay, so the mechanics are God is separated by sin from all of us. And so God sends his son as an atoning sacrifice. And what that does is it turns away for all then. So God sends his son and all of us who are united to him by faith are then found in his love. All of our sins are dealt with. We receive love and mercy, and those who are outside of that propitiation continue under wrath. So those are the mechanics, and the reason was is that God, because he's God, because he is fully the God of justice, fully the God of love, all of those attributes are in his fullness, he cannot overlook sins. They had to be dealt with either in the Son at the cross, or they have to be dealt with on Judgment Day. So these are the mechanics of having both of these. And it matters for suffering because all of us have such an innate desire for things to eventually be made right. But if you have a burning desire for things to finally be made right, but you don't stop and think about what the cross actually accomplished, then you're wanting justice without any way for you to escape that justice. And so, in God's kindness to us, he actually deals with the suffering for us. What gives Christians assurance is not kind of the emotional roller coaster of coming and singing and, you know, being part of a group that for the most part is pretty positive most weeks in and weeks out. What finally gives the Christian real assurance that he'll escape that justice is that God has actually made a way for their sin to be dealt with. So you've got to have that kind of actual redeeming happen. Okay? So that's the first thing. Second, the comfort, and I put there empathy. Right, the traditional way to talk about the difference between sympathy and empathy, sympathy is your heart goes out to whatever another person is going through. Empathy is you are suffering with them. You are joining yourself to, you know, walk a mile in their shoes. That's the difference. So what we see in the cross is that God actually comes and suffers. One of the reasons is to give us comfort, to increase our faith. So let's turn to Hebrews 4. Okay, so let's just look at this passage, verse 14, and I think we'll stop at the end of the chapter there, just those three verses. So Hebrews 4, since then we have a great high priest who passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession. For we do not have a high priest who was unable to sympathize with our weakness, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. So there's been a couple other places in this letter so far as he's trying to say, you know, Jesus is better than the angels, Jesus is better than all, you know, David, Jesus is better than all of these other things. The writer to the Hebrews is grabbing all sorts of data from the Old Testament and just kind of reliving the story of what's happened so far. In this case, it's the high priesthood. And he's going to spell it out even more with Melchizedek in the chapters that come. But we have to learn to kind of think the Bible's thoughts after it, to think God's thoughts. So we think about Jesus as our high priest. What has he accomplished as our high priest? So what would be some of the things that you would want to put on that list? Jesus accomplished what by being our high priest? Yeah, Dave? Okay, so Dave's just pointing out, right, high priests offer sacrifices. That's what Jesus did. He offered a sacrifice. In this case, he offered his own life as an atoning sacrifice. What else? There's a couple other things that high priests do. Yeah, so the priests, all of them as a class, were there to intercede for the people, right? Hebrews 7:25 says, now he always lives to make intercession for us. He has fulfilled that role as our mediator. Okay? Good. All right, so here's a couple things that we pull out from that Hebrews 4 passage. Okay? You can look at your notes there. We're trying to turn to application now, okay? So if that's what the high priest accomplishes, how does it affect our suffering? Why should you feel comforted in your trial because Jesus now is your high priest? Okay? First, he's actually able to understand. Okay, so there in verse 15, you can see that. We don't have the kind of high priest who's unable to sympathize with our weakness. And don't think weakness there is as you just have you're not a Navy SEAL, so you're everything else that's weaker, okay? Weakness in Hebrews is the whole class of humanity who can't overcome their sin, who can't make things right on their own, who can't get out of their own suffering because it's happening to them. It's the time of the way they live. So we don't, right, the writer's making the point, it's not that we have a kind of high priest who can't sympathize, he just stands over, does his thing, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, right? So when we say Jesus understands, the point was made in chapter 2. All right, verse 14 in chapter 2, listen to this. This is kind of an explanation of what do we mean when we say he's really able to sympathize. Since therefore the children share in flesh and blood, he himself likewise partook of the same things, that through death he might destroy the one who has power of death, that is the devil, deliver all those who through the fear of death were subjected to lifelong slavery. For surely it is not angels that he helps, but he helps the offspring of Abraham. Right? So he's taken on this helping mentality and has dove in head first to where we're at. Therefore, he had to be made like his brothers in every respect so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in the service of God to make propitiation for the sins of his people. For because he himself has suffered when tempted, he is able to help those who are being tempted. What does real sympathy look like on his behalf? It was that full dive to live under this present evil age. All right, you see it in the temptations he has to face with Satan. Regardless of whatever he's offered, he's taking the mantle of, just like Adam, who came to this point and failed, he now is succeeding. And it comforts us. It comforts us in his suffering because he's not aloof in any way. Okay? And then you see those other ones there. He's tempted in every way that we are. He faced hunger. He faced any sort of the longings that we normally have as we go through life. To have friends who would stick by him, right? You read some of the discourses that he talks about what friendship means to him with the disciples and how hurt he is when they all abandon him at the cross. Though he knows it, doesn't mean he's not hurt when they're all gone. And yet, he knows that, and he could easily be tempted to despair. All right, left alone again. And yet he trusts God. Yet without sin, because he is this high priest who can make atonement for it. And look at the conclusion there in Hebrews 4. 16 tells us how you combine suffering with what do you do next. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in the time of need. So the author to the Hebrews, his conclusion in his mind after he gets done thinking about, okay, how does this high priest, what does he do for me? What does he give? Okay, I see him suffering for me. His conclusion then is, I got to pray. I've got to pray. I've got to ask God for grace and for help because I'm one of the weak. I'm one of the broken. I need help in this time. So that's the conclusion. So if your suffering doesn't increase your prayer life, you've got some sort of disjunct there that you've got to be thinking about and working on. Okay? So the cross, what it accomplishes for us, how it shows us that God is sympathizing with us. And then the last one, okay, the cross actually is an example for us. It's an example of how we go through the suffering. So you suffer, you pray, like in Hebrews, but now turn to 1 Peter 2. Okay, 1 Peter 2, I'm going to start in verse 18, but just listen to the example that he sets for us. So when I mean example, I mean Peter, writing a letter to Christians like us, specifically says, okay, I know you're getting put through the ringer. How do I want you to respond? He doesn't just simply say, remember Christ the high priest who sympathizes with you. Remember God who dealt with your actual sin. There's something else he wants to get them to do. It's this. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. Right? So they're in your mind, they're getting treated unjustly. For this is a gracious thing. When mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin, you're beaten and you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing, a favorable thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. You are called to suffering. He suffered, we suffer right along the way. Verse 22. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Okay, so that's why suffering is an issue with faith. Because when Jesus suffered, he had to then continue to entrust himself to God. You see that in the end of verse 23 there? He continued entrusting to himself to him who judges justly. So Jesus had it in his mind that there will be a justice that will be dealt with, but in the meantime, I can entrust myself to him, to his Father. But the point there is not just thinking about Jesus as our high priest, but that he set this example for us. Look what he did. When he was reviled, when words were spoken about him that were horrible, rarely did he try to make a long justification of, this is not really true. There are plenty of reasons to defend and try and speak up against your name. But that's not what he's talking about here. He was reviled, treated as scum. And what does it say his return was? He did not turn that back on them. He didn't revile them in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten. He did not threaten that he would get back at them, is what it entails. Because he was entrusting himself, knowing God will deal with all of this in the end. And then it finishes there, verse 24. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed, for you were straying like sheep and have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. So any Christian who then looks at Christ's suffering and sees, okay, there's an example of how I'm going to walk in the rest of my life, is entrusting himself to say, the shepherd of my soul will carry me through to the end. That's how Peter finishes this passage. You can actually trust that what happens in your suffering then works out. So we'll start dealing with just maybe some specific cases after Mozingo. But you can see that all of these things that the cross helps achieve or explain or teach us, this is the framework of which we take everything that comes to us. And one of the reasons is because I can't just trust that one thing that happens to one person is going to feel or be sensed as suffering by someone else. One person loses a job. I know people who lose their job and are actually somewhat thankful because they didn't know how to quit it and now they can actually go do the thing, right? They don't treat it like suffering. But if I was to lose my job, I don't know what my other prospects are. And I'm guessing I would start getting really, really worried probably pretty, pretty quickly. It would be a suffering to me. And so whatever that suffering is that you find yourself in, this is the kind of grid, and this is the kind of thing that we want people just to have as the routine way that they talk about suffering in the church. Because we're all going to get punched in the mouth, right? At some time, it comes in a whole host of different ways. And so you respond based on these things that you're thinking about. Yeah, Dave? Yes.
If God is the same yesterday, today, and forever, how would you be comforted prior to Jesus? In other words, what would Matt say to Job, for instance, prior to the cross? If we've got the same God and he offers the same comfort, but we haven't seen it yet.
Yeah, I mean, to Job, right, I would go back and I would say, what we know in Genesis 3 is eventually the serpent's going to be smashed. And there's going to be one of the sons of Eve who is going to come and will someday. So we know that God will mete out justice perfectly to everyone. Put your hope in the one to come. So that's going to be the routine throughout, you know, everyone before that. And Job has some of those lines. I know my Redeemer lives. So however he's thinking about his suffering, he still has in his mind of, I will not be swept under the justice because my hope is in my God redeeming me in some way. Even if he doesn't know yet that, and have the kind of revealed testimony that we do, that we have a God who has actually sent the Redeemer and now we look back to what he's done. So just flip the time frame on it. Yeah, Dave? Yeah, I think there's some different things on what Paul goes through as well. Yeah, that 2 Corinthians, he gets rung through the ringer several times, and he actually uses it as a reason you should trust his word. Yeah. Okay. Let's get ready for worship.